Declarations of Independence. What were the intolerable acts? British authorities were stunned by the Boston Tea Party. In their wanton destruction of private property, and so much at that, the Americans had gone too far this time. They must be taught their place, subordinate to England and to Parliament. In 1774, Parliament passed the punitive Coercive Acts, known in the colonies as the Intolerable Acts, legislation designed to do just that. There were five. There was the Boston Port Act, which closed the port of Boston. In order to see it reopened, the city would need to pay the British East India Company back for the tea that had been destroyed. There was the Massachusetts Government Act, which threw the colony under the direct control of the British government. Gone was the old colonial charter. Gone was the colonial prerogative of appointing or electing most government officials. Now they'd almost all be appointed by the king or his governing appointees or Parliament. Mostly gone, too, was that most sacred of Massachusetts political traditions, the town meeting. Such gatherings were to be limited to just one per year. There was the Administration of Justice Act, which allowed for royal officials in America, accused of offense while in the line of duty, to be moved to Britain or elsewhere within the empire for trial. Somewhere it was unlikely the witnesses requisite for conviction could follow. There was the Quartering Act, applicable to all of the colonies, which took control over the provision of housing for British troops, took it out of the hands of the various colonial assemblies, and put it into the hands of the royal governors, who could then requisition suitable unoccupied quarters for them, even if those quarters happened to be privately owned. Then there was the Quebec Act, which, though not a direct response to the Boston Tea Party, was passed at the same time as the other four. American colonists themselves considered it one of the intolerable acts, not only because it enlarged the province of Quebec at the expense of rival colonial claims, but because it guaranteed the free practice of Roman Catholicism. The coercive acts enraged the colonists of Massachusetts, and not just firebrands like Sam Adams. Many law-abiding citizens in Boston felt that they were being unfairly punished for the actions of a relative handful of troublemakers. Were Bostonians to be given no chance to defend themselves in their behavior? While residents of Massachusetts fumed over their loss of governmental control, residents of other colonies now worried for their own political institutions. If Parliament and the Crown could simply declare such a system for Massachusetts, why not similar proclamations for the rest? Citizens throughout the colonies likewise worried about the precedent set by the trying of royal officials in courts outside of America. Not only might this facilitate the escape of the guilty, it was also a slap in the face of the colonials, who were apparently unfit to administer justice themselves. Had the British forgotten the fair trial of the Redcoats in the wake of the Boston Massacre? And while quartering troops no one wanted was bad enough, it was far worse now to be further deprived of property rights via gubernatorial requisitions. To add insult to injury, at a time when New Englanders were being punished, it seemed the colony's northern, non-Protestant neighbors, whom they had recently fought during the French and Indian War, were being offered preferential treatment. Clearly, the Intolerable Acts were meant to quarantine Boston, to sequester that vexatious city from the rest of America. But this failed miserably. Colonists from every colony not only followed events in Massachusetts closely, but thousands from as far away as Georgia donated foodstuffs, livestock, and cash to the beleaguered residents of Boston. Unwittingly, the British themselves were cultivating a sense of shared American grievance. Not all lawmakers in Britain approved of the coercive acts. One of America's last friends in Parliament, Edmund Burke, argued that an American colony could either be forced into obedience to each and every British law or be, quote, left to govern itself by its own internal policy, end quote. The latter, clearly, was the more practical solution. And besides, Burke argued, opposition to Parliament's various taxes was so universal in the colonies that to force the issue was to invite inevitable and general resistance. warned Burt to his fellow parliamentarians, "This is the day, then, that you wish to go to war with America." More important, however, was George III's position, and he was delighted at the tough stance Parliament had taken toward feisty Massachusetts. The king appointed as the colony's new governor none other than military man Thomas Gage, the general we met in the last session in New York. This was an important decision, for it was Gage's own philosophy, vis-a-vis the Americans, which had actually formed a basis for the coercive acts themselves. When news of the Boston Tea Party had reached London, Gage, who happened to be there, was summoned to the king's presence so that the monarch and his ministers might, quote, hear his ideas as to the mode of compelling Boston to submit to whatever may be thought necessary, end quote. The ministers listened, and the intolerable acts were the result. In 1774, Gage entered Boston. Though he was cordially welcomed, he remained vigilant and suspicious. His enforcement of the coercive acts made him few friends. Once he sent a small army to prevent Salem from holding a town meeting. The army was unsuccessful after the residents of Salem barricaded themselves inside the town hall. He was just as unsuccessful at stopping the Bostonians, who likewise managed to hold illegal town meetings. The new governor refused to show any special favor toward the colony's Congregationalist leaders, denying them a request for an official day of fasting and prayer, for example, and thereby quickly isolated himself from them, too. When Gage packed the courts with loyalist judges, as was his prerogative according to the Massachusetts Government Act, local juries simply refused to serve. This was all very exasperating to Thomas Gage. Finally, he resolved that the moment for, quote, conciliating, moderation, reasoning, is over, end quote. And then he said this, quote, nothing can be done but by forcible means, end quote. Writing to London, Gage explained, quote, I mean to avoid any bloody crisis as long as possible, unless forced into it by themselves, or the colonists, which may happen, end quote. What was the First Continental Congress? Writing to his son William in 1773, Benjamin Franklin outlined his own view of the relationship between the colonies and the mother country. Quote, from a long and thorough consideration of the subject, I am indeed of opinion that the Parliament has no right to make any law whatever binding on the colonies, that the king, and not the king, lords, and commons collectively, is their sovereign. End quote. A young Thomas Jefferson went into much more detail in his 1774 A Summary View of the Rights of British America, in which he laid out an erudite political philosophy for the British Empire that would preserve the rights of its various parts. Let's go into one of my classrooms for just a moment and explore his ideas.
And when the other colonies see this, they are very worried. This is how the British government is going to handle our protest for our rights. Send in the military, send in the navy, close down the ports, take over the government. And so there's a lot of fear up and down the colonies. So this is not just a Massachusetts thing. The Intolerable Acts are the last straw. We have another Congress being called. And this word Congress is important. I think I mentioned this on day one. What is a Congress? Anyone?
A group of representatives.
Good. A group of representatives representing their states, basically. Their sovereign states. A Congress is not a parliament or a legislature. A Congress is a meeting of ambassadors. And there are a lot of famous Congresses in history. You know, like the Congress of Vienna after the Napoleonic Wars, just a few years later. It was not a meeting of people from the same country. It was a meeting of people from different countries getting together to figure out the post-war world. The Congress of Westphalia, 1648. You know, after all the religious, the 30 Years' War in Europe, a meeting of people from different countries, not from the same country. That's what a Congress is, and that's what they called it on purpose. None of them considered themselves necessarily part of the same state. They were all part of different states, meeting together in a Congress as ambassadors. Anyway, so remember that. We'll bring that up again. So the First Continental Congress gets together, and this time they're going to draft a petition to the king that's a little different than the Stamp Act Congress petition. And they're influenced by this guy named Thomas Jefferson, who's a really young guy from Virginia. He himself is pretty new to the House of Burgesses there. And before the Virginia delegation goes off to the First Continental Congress in 1774, Jefferson writes up some instructions for them that they could, you know, just basically suggestions. says, here, take this, maybe use this. And they do. His suggestions are published as a pamphlet. This is how Jefferson sees the British Empire. This is how most Americans see it. They say, look, here's the deal. The empire has people from all over the world. Maybe we should put England there. Scotland, England, Virginia, Jamaica, Pennsylvania, New York, Bengal, islands in the Caribbean. They all have their own parliaments. They all have their own legislatures. They tax themselves. They run themselves. The only thing they share is the king. They don't share Britain's parliament. They all have their own, but they do share a king. And so, logically, if one of these parliaments were to rise up and try and kind of take over the rest, or usurp power from the rest, whose job is it to put them back in line? It's the king's job. Does that make sense? Basically what Thomas Jefferson's doing, this guy that no one's ever heard of, he's throwing the gauntlet down at the king's feet, saying, kind of like John Locke, look, you have a job, you have a duty, and if you don't fulfill it, well then, you know, implicitly, we're going to leave and replace you with someone who does, kind of thing. At this point, still no one's talking about independence. They're talking about the king doing his job. We don't know if the king ever saw this pamphlet or read it or whatever, but if he did, he probably would have tossed it aside and said, this Thomas Jefferson guy's a nobody. Where's Virginia again? But anyway, this is the view they took. And when they wrote their petition to the king, it was much more pugnacious like this.
Jefferson's summary view was prepared in part for the Virginia delegates to the First Continental Congress. Committees of correspondence throughout the colonies had, by the summer of 1774, determined that a joint gathering must take place in order to discuss proper and hopefully collective action in the face of the British challenge to their rights as freeborn Englishmen. 55 delegates were thus assembled in Philadelphia by early September, representing each of the colonies except Georgia. Though that colony had sent no delegates, it nevertheless officially pledged to support the Congress's decisions, so they're all represented. Sam Adams was there, as was his less radical cousin, John. Ben Franklin ally Joseph Galloway attended as a Pennsylvania representative. Patrick Henry came, along with Richard Henry Lee and George Washington from Virginia. Noted South Carolinian patriot Christopher Gadsden was present as well. This was a meeting of American luminaries, perhaps unlike any before. But that didn't mean that agreement would come easy. While moderates, like Galloway, argued prudence and restraint, Sam Adams pressed for a showdown. After much back and forth, the radicals won the day, and the First Continental Congress adopted the Suffolk Resolves, a document delivered from Massachusetts to the Congress in Philadelphia by the fast-riding Paul Revere. This declaration, originally drafted by Suffolk County, Massachusetts, called for a general boycott of all British imports, a limiting of American exports to Britain, the nullification or ignoring of the Intolerable Acts, the resignation of officials appointed under the Massachusetts Government Act, non-payment of taxes until the aforementioned act was repealed, the formation of a separate free colonial government for Massachusetts as long as the Intolerable Acts remained in effect, and the raising of militias in all American colonies. The Suffolk Resolves were decidedly revolutionary. Back in Britain, Burke rightly recognized them as a step toward American independence. By adopting the Resolves, the First Continental Congress was stamping intercolonial approval onto the rebellion in Massachusetts. Non-importation, previously formed locally, was now established by the Congress under the name Continental Association, or simply the Association, as a pan-American movement, one that included an enforcement arm organized into committees of inspection. These last met with every merchant and shopkeeper in the colonies, plus tens of thousands of consumers, to convince them to join the boycott. Those who failed to cooperate were shunned or otherwise openly reviled. Some were even forced to make public apologies. What happened at Lexington and Concord? Meanwhile, the British declared Massachusetts, with its rebel counties and shadow government, to be in a state of open rebellion. On the evening of April 18th, Thomas Gage secretly ordered a contingent of around 700 British regulars to march to Concord and seize military supplies allegedly being stored there by the colonial militia. Having received intelligence that these supplies were in danger, the militia had actually moved most of them weeks before. Paul Revere and other riders fanned out into the countryside, warning colonists of the soldiers coming and readying minutemen, or militia members prepared to respond instantly if required, to defend the area. All of this took place during the night, so that by sunrise, Lexington's militia, a rather grand name for a collection of poorly trained farmers, including old men and young boys, had gathered on the village green. It was around this time that the redcoats marched by, and someone fired. The British fired back in a disciplined volley, and in a moment, 8 colonials lay dead on the ground, compared to only 1 redcoat casualty. Outnumbered, the Lexington militia fell back. Word of the killings spread like wildfire. Minutemen poured in from the surrounding countryside. By the time the British troops had arrived and conquered, the road back home was lined with snipers, waiting for them to dare return. In the meantime, the redcoats split up into smaller groups in order to perform a thorough search of Concord. No military supplies were found, but one group of 100 soldiers did run into a mass of 400 militia at Concord's North Bridge. The militia had been instructed not to shoot first, but when the British fired, they returned fire. Both sides suffered dead and wounded before the British retreated. More than 60 years later, the first verse of Ralph Waldo Emerson's Concord Hymn would immortalize the episode thus. By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. Here once the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world. Minutemen made the duration of the soldiers' return march hell via guerrilla-style harassment. Hidden as they were in the trees, sharpshooting colonists picked off redcoats all along the road back to Boston. For almost all of this tactical retreat, the British were under heavy fire. Before it was all over, the battles of Lexington and Concord, including the return march, had cost the British 73 killed, almost 200 wounded, and scores missing. The colonists had fared significantly better, and must have marveled at their success. Both sides surely were shocked at what had just taken place. Thomas Gage managed both a compliment and an insult. Fuming that the Americans displayed a ferocity in fighting the British that they'd never done fighting the French. The bloodshed at Lexington and Concord, now combined with the aforementioned Declaration of Suffolk County, Massachusetts, made famous by the First Continental Congress, to inspire many other similar declarations. In North Carolina, for example, Mecklenburg County issued a declaration, May 1775, that proclaimed that, quote, all laws derived from the authority of the king or Parliament are annulled and vacated, end quote. This came dangerously close to an out-and-out declaration of independence. Nearby Tryon County produced the Tryon Resolves around the same time, this is August 1775, pledging a resort to armed resistance, quote, in maintaining the freedom of our country, end quote, and a determination to follow the Continental Congress. The rebellion was spreading. What was the Second Continental Congress? After Lexington and Concord, Boston was immediately barricaded by the British and surrounded by colonial militia. This early stage of the Revolutionary War is known as the Siege of Boston. In mid-June, intelligence reached colonial forces that the British were going to take and fortify the hills surrounding Boston. Should they succeed, Gage and his redcoats would gain effective control over Boston Harbor, where ships of the Royal Navy now anchored. On the night of June 16th, then, militia leader William Prescott quietly led 1,200 armed colonists to Bunker Hill and Breed's Hill, where, before the arrival of dawn, he oversaw the impressively rapid construction of a small fort atop the ladder, atop Breed's Hill. When day broke, the British were dumbfounded. This fortified colonial presence on the Shamook Peninsula, on which the city of Boston was built, could not stand. And so the British attacked that very day. Amazingly, the colonists held their own, pushing back the first British assault, then the second, with heavy British casualties. During the third push, the American defenders ran out of ammunition, and the redcoats finally managed to take the position. The British had won the Battle of Bunker Hill, but it had been a bittersweet victory. While the Americans suffered 115 killed and over 300 wounded, the British lost over 200 dead and almost 800 wounded. Such were their losses that London authorities began discussing the need for mercenaries in America. Eventually, the British would hire some 30,000 Germans. No longer, too, would the British underestimate American defenses during a frontal attack. Indeed, for years to come, the British would be more cautious all around when it came to engaging the rebels, possibly with great consequence, as we'll see. For the colonials, the battle demonstrated that their own militia, undisciplined and untrained as it was, might stand up to professional British soldiers under the right circumstances. Just weeks before the Battle of Bunker Hill, the Second Continental Congress met in Philadelphia. The First Continental Congress had been in session only between September and October of 74. This Second Continental Congress, established in May of 75, actually wasn't disbanded until March of 81. Here, the delegates began to exercise some control over the unfolding war. A Continental Army was established, and French and Indian War veteran George Washington, who apparently had more military experience than anyone else available, was appointed as its head. The fact that Washington was from Virginia was important, signaling not only the support of the most powerful of the colonies, but also that those radical Puritan Massachusetts men didn't dictate everything. Still, it was one thing to create an army. It was quite another to actually outfit it. This would be costly. Where was the money to come from? The Congress's answer: issue paper money. We'll discuss the impact of this decision in future sessions. On July 6th, 1775, just a couple weeks after Bunker Hill, the Congress adopted the Declaration of the Causes and Necessity of Taking Up Arms, written by Thomas Jefferson and John Dickinson, and possibly prominent South Carolinian John Rutledge. Taxation without representation, the Declaratory Act with its in all cases whatsoever assertion, the hated Vice Admiralty Courts, the Intolerable Acts, each of these was invoked as justification for armed colonial resistance. The Declaration pointed out that the colonies had, separately and jointly, petitioned again and again for redress of their grievances, but to no avail. Parliament, the Declaration insisted, had attempted to enslave the colonies, that's the Declaration's word, enslave, quote, by violence, and have thereby rendered it necessary for us to close with their last appeal from reason to arms, end quote. Despite all of this, indeed, despite functioning as a de facto government, or at least federation of governments, the Congress stopped short of issuing a declaration of independence. It was discussed, it was debated, but vestiges of loyalty to Britain yet remained, and thus no such declaration was produced in 1775. Indeed, the Declaration of the Causes and Necessity of Taking Up Arms explicitly denied that the colonists were seeking independence. Arms had to be taken up, quote, in defense of the freedom that is our birthright, and which we ever enjoyed until the late violation of it, end quote. And those arms would be laid back down the moment, quote, hostilities shall cease on the part of the aggressors, end quote. If the Declaration of the Causes and Necessity of Taking Up Arms was meant to make the British understand the American position so that they, the British, would de-escalate, it failed badly. The British doubled down, in the process turning more American colonials into rebels. In nothing was this better demonstrated than in the December 1775 Prohibitory Act, which barred England from trading with England's American colonies. Royal protection for American ships was also withdrawn. Henceforth, American ports would be blockaded by the Royal Navy, and American merchants on the high seas seized. It was around this time, too, that British authorities began hiring their German mercenaries, called Hessians, as many of them hailed from the German state of Hesse-Cassel. Such actions couldn't have been designed better to convert loyalists and fence-sitters into so-called patriots. Were there multiple declarations of independence? The year before, so we're talking 1774, an Englishman named Thomas Paine, having met Benjamin Franklin and received letters of introduction from him, immigrated to Pennsylvania and got into the print media industry, quickly becoming the editor of the Pennsylvania Magazine and turning it into the most widely read such publication in all of the colonies. Paine's ties to Franklin thrust him into revolutionary circles almost immediately, and, at his American friend's urging, in early January 1776, he published an essay he'd written under the title Common Sense. Paine's tract became a bestseller virtually overnight, arguably the most popular printed work ever produced in America, right up to the present. Within 90 days of its release, it had been purchased by roughly 1 out of every 8 adult colonists. Most Americans read Common Sense, and if they couldn't read, someone else read it to them. In true Enlightenment fashion, Paine's essay used reason, or common sense, to excoriate the very notion of monarchy and the men and women who wore the crown. Quote, "Men who look upon themselves born to reign and others to obey soon grow insolent. Selected from the rest of mankind, their minds are early poisoned by importance. And the world they act in differs so materially from the world at large that they have but little opportunity of knowing its true interests, and when they succeed to the government, are frequently the most ignorant and unfit of any throughout the dominions." End quote. Or there's this nugget. Quote, "But where, says some, is the King of America? I'll tell you, friend, he reigns above, and doth not make havoc of mankind like the royal brute of Britain." End quote. All the old religious arguments in support of kings and queens, all historical justifications for monarchical rule, every oft-pronounced attempt at legitimizing the crown, Paine seemed to rip the foundations out from under them all. Monarchs ruled by coercion, not divine sanction. They made serious and often criminal mistakes all the time, even if their advisors were the ones to always take the blame. Monarchs were often stupid, or brutish, or unprepared, and their rule was arbitrary anyway. In addition to questioning monarchy in general, Common Sense introduced ideas of independence from Britain. This was important since most Americans with revolutionary leanings nevertheless felt apprehensive about actual secession from the empire. There were economic incentives for preserving a connection. For example, leaving Britain meant that American merchants would find themselves outside of the British tariff wall. There were liberty-based arguments for preserving a connection, too. Colonists with a propensity for republicanism feared that even should they win and British authority be ejected, the standing American army and conquering American general inevitably left behind could pose an even greater threat to freedom than faraway King George. Paine cut through such misgivings by an appeal to common sense. Quote, "Small islands, not capable of protecting themselves, are the proper objects for kingdoms to take under their care. But there's something absurd in supposing a continent to be perpetually governed by an island." End quote. Europe and not England is the parent country of America, Paine argued. This new world hath been the asylum for the persecuted lovers of civil and religious liberty from every part of Europe. It was time, Common Sense urged, to stop considering England the mother country. Many of these ideas had certainly been quietly uttered during private conversations all over the colonies for months, perhaps years. But Thomas Paine seemed to put them all into words, distilling the thoughts, ideas, observations, and frustrations of Americans into an easily digestible format. These ideas were, it now appeared, simply common sense. Something about common sense, too, captured the hearts and minds of hundreds of thousands of Americans, as if they might be part of something historically unique, hugely important, and potentially earth-shaking. Quote, "We have it in our power to begin the world over again. A situation similar to the present hath not happened since the days of Noah until now. The birthday of a new world is at hand, and a race of men, perhaps as numerous as all Europe contains, are to receive their portion of freedom from the events of a few months." End quote. Paine's call was for, quote, "the free and independent states of America." End quote. Thousands began reading as agitators for their rights as freeborn Englishmen. Thousands finished reading as agitators for independence. It should be noted, however, that while a third, possibly half, of American colonials strongly supported independence throughout the war, another third remained somewhat noncommittal to either side, while a final third maintained loyalty to the British throughout. In any case, from May through July 1776, Virginia, the largest, most powerful, and most populous of the colonies, held its fifth Revolutionary or Patriot Convention, the Fifth Virginia Convention, sometimes referred to as the May Convention, at Williamsburg. Virginia had already seen action in the unfolding Revolutionary War. Its colonial militia had defeated the governor's forces and effectively driven him and his troops out of the colony altogether, with victory at the Battle of Great Bridge. Virginia's militia commander described the engagement as, quote, a second Bunker's Hill affair, end quote. Now, on May 15th, the convention adopted three resolutions, one declaring that Virginia must have a Declaration of Rights, one declaring that Virginia must be a republic, and one declaring that Virginia desired to form federal ties with like-minded colonies. The government of Virginia, as formerly constituted, was, quote, totally dissolved, end quote, as a result of King George III's having, quote, abandoned the helm of government and declared us out of his allegiance and protection, end quote. This was a declaration of independence, Virginia's independence. Lest there be any confusion on the matter, the convention additionally instructed its delegates to the Continental Congress to support a joint declaration of independence. That night, the residents of Williamsburg took down the Union Jack flying in front of the Capitol, replacing it instead with a new flag, that of the Continental Union. A month and a half later, on July 2, 1776, the Continental Congress finally agreed to follow Virginia's lead. Let's head to Philadelphia and take a look. In June 1776, the Second Continental Congress met in this building behind me, right here in Philadelphia. The main topic of conversation and debate, of course, being independence. On June 7th, Richard Henry Lee, the Virginian, proposed out-and-out independence. It's called Lee's Resolution. And actually, the language in Lee's Resolution, a lot of it is going to make its way into, ultimately, the Declaration of Independence. Lee was asked to write the Declaration of Independence. He was first choice, but he was already busy on the committee writing the Articles of Confederation, and later he had to go home anyway. His wife was sick. So instead, another Virginian was selected, a much younger Virginian, but linguistically talented. His name was Thomas Jefferson. And if we're to believe John Adams, Jefferson also tried to reject the appointment. He wanted Adams to do it. But in the end, according to Adams, he convinced Jefferson that a Virginian must do it. Virginia was the most important. And so Jefferson acquiesced. To help Jefferson, a committee of five was organized, including Jefferson, John Adams, Ben Franklin, Roger Sherman, and Robert Livingston. These five were to work together in writing the Declaration of Independence, with Jefferson as the primary author. And that's what happened. They worked on it for almost a month. And then, on July 2nd, a motion passed in Congress, assembled, for a joint Declaration of Independence, keeping in mind that some of the states had already declared independence on their own. This is a joint Declaration of Independence. And on the 4th of July, John Hancock signed the document, and on the 5th of July, the Declaration of Independence was published, and by November, all of its now famous signatories had affixed their names to the document. The Declaration of Independence declared that the colonies were independent states. Now, this is important language, since the word state refers to a sovereign polity. In other words, one which answers to no higher political authority. Today, Germany is a state, since the German government doesn't answer to any higher political authority with the power of coercion, unless one counts the European Union, but that's another conversation. Japan is a state. Canada is a state. When the Declaration of Independence was passed, Virginia was a state. So was Massachusetts and Pennsylvania and South Carolina and every other colony declaring its independence and separate statehood. Americans today still use the term state to refer to the various United States, though they aren't truly states anymore. Note the use, too, of the term Congress. In other words, a meeting of ambassadors. That's actually the definition of John Adams, a meeting of ambassadors. As such, Congress was not analogous with Parliament. Parliament was the legislative body made up of representatives of a single unitary state. The Congress never saw itself that way. Rather, Congress was made up of ambassadors or delegates from 13 colonies, now 13 independent states. This will become vitally important later as Americans debate the nature of the original Union. The first three sections of the Declaration had virtually no legal effect. Instead, first laying out the states' ideas about natural rights and the origin and power of government, then, second, justifying separation by listing all of the ways that King and Parliament had transgressed their powers and purpose. Note Locke's influence. Here's the Declaration of Independence. I'm going to read it to you. In Congress, July 4, 1776. The unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. He has refused his assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance, unless suspended in their operation, till his assent should be obtained, and when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records, for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time after such disillusions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose obstructing the laws of naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has kept among us, in times of peace, standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation. For quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states, for cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies, for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments, for suspending our own legislatures, and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages, and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. He has constrained our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They too have been deaf to the voice of justice and of consanguinity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends. The fourth or last section of the Declaration was the effective section, in other words, the part with legal effect. Again, notice who is declaring independence. If you're reading the Declaration of Independence, take note of capital letters, plurals, and pronouns. What do the independent states now claim to be able to do? So I'll now read the fourth or last section, the effective section of the Declaration of Independence. Quote, "We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these united colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. In sum, Parliament's punishment for the Boston Tea Party came in the form of the Coercive Acts, called in the colonies the Intolerable Acts, which effectively cut Boston off from the world, while also depriving Massachusetts of its own government. A groundswell of support for the beleaguered colonists of Massachusetts developed throughout the colonies. Influenced in part by Jefferson's summary view, the First Continental Congress adopted the Radical Suffolk Resolves, among other things organizing a general boycott of British goods. Events escalated into a shooting war at the battles of Lexington and Concord after British troops attempted to seize militia supplies. A second Continental Congress met in 1775, issuing a declaration of the causes and necessity of taking up arms. While the Congress met, the Battle of Bunker Hill demonstrated that the unfolding war was likely to be a very bloody one. By early 1776, Tom Paine's common sense was converting agitators for English rights into agitators for American independence, and by May, Virginia had actually declared its own independence. In early July, the Continental Congress adopted the Jefferson-penned Declaration of Independence as 13 states united in federation. The states had seceded from the British Empire, and each now claimed full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. With a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, the Declaration's signees mutually pledged to each other their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor.